From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, another installment in our look at the history of the Soviet Union with Professor Luciana Bone.
What I intend to cover is 1928 to 1933, the period of the collectivization of agriculture. But I want to make a preamble, because we're going to be talking about Stalin. I'd like to make a preamble. As far as I'm concerned, the point of going over the past of how the Soviet Union developed from 1917 to 1990 is to try to understand what were the internal forces that caused it to collapse in 1990. And so learn something about how to avoid a similar collapse in future, and to understand the policies of still existing socialist countries such as China that are trying to prevent a similar collapse. So audiences should be warned that my interest is in a dialectical analysis. That means examining both what was accomplished and what within that accomplishment were failures or neglect, or other flaws that created the forces that eventually emerged to overthrow socialism in the USSR.
Right, the contradictions, right.
Right. In other words, mine is a class analysis of the Soviet Union, and I leave the moralistic approach to others. I mean, it comes in occasionally, but the whole thrust is to attempt the scientific route, how the classes, whether they existed and how they interacted and what brought the downfall. So in 1928, Stalin made a choice. And in his own words, in 1935, in his report on the progress of, in general, industrial economic. In 1935, he said, "It is obvious that a choice had to be made between two plans, between the plan of retreat, that was the new economic policy of Lenin, between the plan of retreat, which, in Stalin's view, would have led and was bound to lead," he says, "to the defeat of socialism." Here I interject that he wasn't really keen on the new economic policy, but he followed, Lenin's policies and supported them. So between the plan of retreat, as even Lenin had characterized it, and the plan of advance, as he sees it, which led and has already brought us to the victory of socialism in our country. I will get back to that claim, victory of socialism in our country. Does that mean that our country no longer had classes?
Right.
Okay. That's really crucial. That's my criticism, actually. And many other historians' criticism that, and Mao's criticism, that the Soviet Communist Party refused to acknowledge the existence of classes. And this is kind of premature, but that's important.
Right.
Anyway, by 1928, Russia had inherited from the past and still had a technically backward, impoverished, and ruined country. It was ruined by 4 years of imperialist war, as it is known in Soviet Union, which was the First World War, 1914-1918. And it was ruined again by 3 years of civil war, and the country was semi-literate. The population was semi-literate, had a low technical level with isolated industrial oases here and there, lost in a sea of dwarf peasant farms, Stalin's words, oasis lost in the sea of dwarf peasant farms. So the task, as far as he was concerned, was to transfer this country from medieval darkness to modern industry and mechanized agriculture. So there were intense meetings in 1928 between Stalin and the Central Committee discussing this proposal of how to move the country from into modernity. So this is how he presented in his own words the proposal. He pointed out our country was passing through a period of an appalling dearth of technique. There were not enough machines for industry. There were no machines for agriculture. There were no machines for transport. That at elementary technical base, without which the reorganization of a country and industrial lines is inconceivable. There were only isolated prerequisites for the creation of such a base. A first-class industry had to be built up. This industry had to be so directed as to be capable of technically reorganizing not only industry, but also agriculture and our railway transport. And to achieve this, it was necessary to make sacrifices and to exercise the most rigorous economy in everything. It was necessary to economize on food, on schools, on textiles, in order to accumulate the funds required for building industry. There was no other way of overcoming the dearth of technique, technology, I guess.
Yeah, and of material base in terms of factories, roads, electrical transmission lines, all of the what they had to do. In essence, unlike the evolutionary processes that over time led to the accumulation of capital and the construction of cities, factories, roads, all of the infrastructure that existed at that point in much mm-hmm. of Europe and in the United States and in Japan and parts of China, etc., they had to mm-hmm. take a piece of paper and lay out a plan to build that from scratch, using just the power of the people, their labor, the application of that, and the raw materials that they had while they were under a state of international political and often military siege.
Exactly. The only ally they had, ironically, since 1924, was Germany. Both were pariah states. I'm interjecting here, following your comment. Mm-hmm. Both Russia and Germany, and Soviet Union by now, and Germany were pariah states to the West. Germany was under order to disarm and to pay back the debt to mainly American capitalists. Right. In fact, there is a theory in history that World War One, that the United States entered World War One in 1917 because it was lending money to both England and Germany, and they decided that Germany would be the debtor country.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Just so our audience knows, just to remind them, the First World War, the First Imperialist War, whatever term you want to use for it, 1914 to 1918, and the United States entered in 1917.
It was a very short time, yeah.
Yeah.
Same thing they did in World War II, really.
Mm-hmm, for sure, absolutely.
Yeah. So, anyway, the Soviet Union managed to sign a treaty with Germany, which in the 20s was the Weimar Republic, the liberal state. They signed an agreement of for trade, raw materials against consumer goods, things they needed. They signed it at Rapallo, outside of Genoa, in 1924. The Soviet Union provided territory for training of the German military, too. And there are such ironies, And so the only ally they had was Germany, which had taken a good chunk of the Soviet Union. Right. Now, you mentioned the accumulation of capital that is needed mm-hmm. to launch an industrial revolution, right? You
right.
just did.
Right.
Correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're talking, yeah. for example, if you're going to build a factory, first you need tools. If you're going to have tools, first you need the factory that the tools are built in. You need the metal forgeries. It's like a whole layer after layer after layer of essentially the remains of applying labor to raw materials. That's what capital actually is. I mean, people use ledger sheets
right.
to measure it, but this is the real capital. And that stuff didn't exist yet. You still had, here's the rocks with the materials in it. Here's some guys. Build a factory.
Yeah, that's right. Now, to contrast, so I'm saying here that the accumulation of funds for industrialization came from the collectivization of agriculture.
Right.
And so by 1933, the state owned 100% of the land. And this, in my view, I don't think it's strange. And this was a kind of primitive accumulation of capital within the state's own territory.
Right. That's right.
This is important to notice because the industrialization of Europe, the Industrial Revolution in Europe, was acquired, the accumulation of capital for that industrialization was acquired through the loot of the New World.
Right.
Through slavery and genocide. So let us not hear, you know, moralistic howls here about the kulaks, etc., as we will get to eventually.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it was a way of accumulating capital, and it was done in agriculture. Now, to move on, in 1928, when the proposal was being made, apart from scarcity and underdevelopment, there was the problem of defense, the army. Now, in 1924, the China policy had failed. China policy was an attempt ordered by Lenin to secure the Eastern Front, that is the Pacific Front, to prevent Japanese attacks. And we have to remember that in 1904, the Tsar Navy was completely destroyed by the Japanese in an unbelievable defeat, which really fueled the 1905 revolution.
Yep.
The army was already pretty pissed in 1905, that is the Navy. Yep. I mean, it was sunk, every ship.
Yep.
You know, and the only Navy people that survived were those who were on the land. So this policy to try to secure or have a foothold and protect the East actually failed because they had, Lenin had approached Sun Yat-sen, who was mounting a bourgeois revolution.
Right.
Lenin died, Sun Yat-sen died, Chiang Kai-shek came on, and anyway, it wasn't doable, and the troops were retreated, and they couldn't handle it, you know. So this was another problem. That is, we have an army. It's small by Russian standards. It's 600,000 troops under arms, and all we have is 600 million budgetary allocation, 6 million rubles, which was sufficient to feed them and clothe them, but nothing else.
That's like 10 rubles.
You see?
10 rubles per person. Not a lot.
You figured it out.
Yeah,
that's
not
right.
A lot. Yep.
So we have this problem of how to modernize. I mean, the army, of how to bring it up to snuff, because by 1928, some, you know, and throughout the decade, since 1917, since the Civil War, they knew that the capitalist world countries would be coming, after the Bolshevik Revolution.
And they did.
And they did.
Yep. Almost and immediately, how. That's right. Yep.
And
so that's the context, that's the context for why Lenin wanted to pacify the East. They were already engaged with expeditionary forces from the West on Russian territory. They had troops from the UK and the US and France and who knows where else inside Russia fighting.
Something else I wanted to add here, but I can't remember. Yeah, the Japanese, as a matter of fact, jumping to about, I don't know, the end of the 30s, 1940s, I can't remember exactly the date, but it was Marshal Zhukov, who wasn't a marshal then, who gave a thrashing to who defeated the Japanese army at the Battle of Khalkhin Gol.
That's right.
And as a matter of fact, the Japanese never engaged with the Red Army again. I mean, you know, that was 1940. Mm. But in 1920, Japan was a possible threat, yes.
Yep.
And in addition to the army not being equipped up to snuff, what we had is also an underdeveloped oil industry in the Caucasus. It needed equipment, it needed technology, it needed technical expertise. Now, with the money from the collectivization of agriculture, the state, Stalin hired the Schlumberger brothers in France and paid in gold and brought that up to snuff. So I'm going to talk about how collectivization was done, but before that, I'm going into the effects, really. Now, I think it's worth quoting Stalin's report in 1935 here as to what happened as a result of collectivization. So he wrote, he reported in 1935 this way. During the past few years, industry and towns have grown at least double as compared with the old days. We now have at least twice as many cities and city dwellers, industries and workers engaged in industry. Yeah, we have twice as many as in the old days. So he asks, what does this mean? It means that we have taken several million toilers from the countryside and transferred them to the city. That we have made them workers and employees, and that they are now, together with the rest of the workers, advancing our industry. Now, this is interesting, because what emerges here, at least to my eye, is what has happened. What used to be a peasant country, he indicates, is becoming an industrial country. That is, labor from the countryside is being transferred to the cities. Now, do you see where I'm going?
Yes.
So among, you know, and people who, so we have to remember history. How did England produce its industrial workers, which right. under the condition of capitalism are called proletarians
right.
rather than, you know, workers, that is subordinate rather than in charge. How did England manage to stuff the cities with industrial workers? By, with enclosures.
Right.
By making it impossible for the landlords in England, in the countryside, the big gentry, enclosed fields that used to be open to the villagers to even collect twigs to make fires, to cook stuff on.
Right.
They did this, the enclosure were, because they wanted to have a monoculture, grain. Grain was gold as the world population was increasing. So there was, you know, there was a forcible action in England. That's never mentioned.
Right. It's the industrialization of agriculture, you know, to, up to large scale, in essence. You start with, go back to the prevailing conditions in, you know, during the medieval times when you had the, you know, that whole epic of feudalism. And then the breakup of those into small farms, which, you know, were productive for the people that lived on them, but not mm-hmm. to sustain the development of large cities and industrial, commercial activity outside of the farms. And then the forcible, by one mechanism or another, consolidation of those lands and the industrialization of agriculture, which was done, it wasn't done by handing out flowers and deeds to people in England either.
Even bread, yeah.
Yep, that's right. And there were people that were starving all over Europe and the Americas and Asia, because they weren't cut in on the deal that resulted in industrial agriculture. And there were millions of casualties there also.
Yes, that's right. A century earlier, and that was free trade, we have the example of Ireland. We have the example of the famine in Ireland, 1 million
right,
people.
Right. Yep.
Why? Because whatever was produced in Ireland was exported to England.
Right.
And we have other factors. But famines were a fact of life throughout Europe from ever, but increasingly from the 1700s. So there was nothing unusual in that, that, and, you know, industrialization, modernization meant controlling those famines.
That's
not
right.
Creating
That's
them.
Right.
As,
yeah, the famine wasn't an accident. I mean, there were obviously the factors like, rainfall and all of that, and errors in technology, because they would over-farm areas and, lose all the nutrients, whatever. There was that factor. But it was also just a part of economic planning. We need to do this. Well, over here, by the way, 1 million people are going to die. So what? Okay, anyway, we have to do this. That was part of the process of doing it all throughout the West, as they mm-hmm. moralize about Stalin.
Yeah, that's right. And furthermore, in the 1935 report that Stalin reads to the Central Committee, continuously makes this link between the importance of agriculture to the development of industry. It remained crucial. Production of grain was crucial, and he says, whereas several million toilers formerly connected with the countryside, this is what he says, we must produce more grain. This is even in 1935, because, number one, several million toilers formerly connected with the countryside used to produce grain. Today, they not only do not produce grain, but themselves require that grain, and grain that should be brought to them from the countryside, and our cities will grow, and the demand for grain will increase.
Right.
Furthermore, in the old days, we had less industrial crops than now. We are now producing twice as much cotton as in the old days. As to flax, sugar beet, and other industrial crops, we are producing incomparably more than in the old days. And what follows from this, he says? It follows from this that the people who are engaged in the production of industrial crops cannot adequately engage in grain growing. And therefore, we must have large stocks of grain for the people who are producing industrial crops, so that it may be possible steadily to increase the production of industrial crops, the cultivation of cotton, flax, sugar beet, sunflower seed, and so forth. And we must steadily increase the production of industrial crops if we want to advance our light industries and our food industries. So there you have the second reason for the increase in demand for grain, he says. Further, I have already said that in the old days, our country used to produce 4 or 5 billion poods, I haven't checked what that is, of grain annually. The Tsarist ministers at that time used to say, we will go short ourselves, but we will export grain. Now, he quotes the Tsarist minister. Now, who were the people who went short? He says, not the Tsarist ministers, of course. The people who went short were 20 or 30 million poor peasants who did indeed go short and lived the life of semi-starvation in order that the Tsarist minister might send grain abroad. Such was the state of affairs in the old days. But times with us have entirely changed. The Soviet government cannot permit the population to go short. For 2 or 3 years now, we no longer have any poor unemployment. Unemployment has ceased, undernourishment has disappeared, and we no longer, and we have firmly entered on the path of prosperity. Now, you know, you will ask, what has become of the 20 or 30 million hungry poor peasants? Well, they have joined the collective farms, and they get an income, a secure, you know, salary, have established themselves there, and are successfully building a life of prosperity for themselves. And what does this mean? It means that we now need far more grain to feed our toiling peasants than in the old days, because the poor peasants of yesterday, who are the collective farmers of today, having established themselves in the collective farms, must have enough grain with which to build a prosperous life. Am I going too long here?
But no, that's good. No, that's good.
You know, they have it, and will have still more. That is the third reason for the colossal increase in the demand for grain in our country. Further, everybody is now saying that the material conditions of the toilers in our country have considerably improved. The life has become better, happier. That, of course, is true. But the result is that the population has begun to multiply far more rapidly than in the old days. Mortality has declined, births are increasing, and the net growth of population is incomparably greater. That, of course, is good, and we welcome it. We now have an annual increase of population of about 3 million. That means that every year there is an increase equal to one whole Finland. And for some reason, there was a laughter among the audience.
Right.
I'm almost finished. Well, the result is that we have to feed more and more people. There you have another reason for the increase in the demand for bread. Finally, one more reason. I have spoken of people and their increased demand for bread. But man's food does not consist of bread alone. He also needs meats, fats. The growth of the city, the increase in industrial crops, the general growth of the population, a prosperous life, all this results in an increase in the demand for meat and fats. It is therefore necessary to have a well-ordered animal husbandry with great quantity of livestock.
Now we're seeing again here, I mean, what you're doing basically is layering one element of an economy upon another. We got to stop there, and we'll pick it up here next week, because this is the real, literally the meat of economic development.
Yes. I know. But thank you so much, Don.
And thank you too, Luciana. We will speak with you again next week.
Very good. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.